Welcome to the Rainmakers Podcast. This show is going to be an exploration on the world's best investors from past and present to see how exactly they made their returns. In this episode, we will cover the early career of Kirk Kerkorian. Kirk Kerkorian became a multi-billionaire through his shrewd deals in airlines, casinos, Hollywood studios, and even activist investing in the automotive industries. By the time Kirk died at 98 years old in 2015, he had a net worth of $4.2 billion. The reason we are going to go over his career is because he is a person who achieved remarkable success without a formal education or industry experience in any of the fields that he invested in outside of aviation. He made a knack of being in high-risk, high-reward opportunities where he learned the essence of the industries he was in before becoming the biggest player in them. He was a determined entrepreneur who developed a sense of risk-taking as a child and turned his small airline business into owning the biggest hotel on the Las Vegas Strip in 1969, being the biggest shareholder in the conglomerate Transamerica, and then taking over the Hollywood studio MGM. Kerkorian's career is full of so many great lessons that I couldn't do it in just one episode. So I hope you guys enjoy it, and if you do, please subscribe and leave a review. Now, let's jump into the story of Kirk Kerkorian. Kirk Kerkorian was born in 1917 in Fresno, California, to two Armenian parents. Kerkorian would get his first lessons in risk-taking from experiencing the constant rises and falls his family endured from the ventures his father would do. Early on, Kerkorian's father, Aharon, became wealthy fairly quickly after investing well in different ranches he owned where he produced raisins during World War I. Raisins were the perfect food to produce because the army needed a food source to bring with them during the war that would not go bad. So Aharon invested heavily in producing raisins and became one of the biggest producers in the state of California during this time. Others warned him of a looming recession, but Aharon didn't care, and he treaded on. Well, we now know that a recession did in fact come in 1920 and it lasted 18 months. But this wouldn't be the reason why Aharon had actually gone bust. In the pipes that Kerkorian and his family used to drink water out of, oil would start to run out of the pipes first. Aharon noticed this and he thought his ranch had oil in it. He then contacted San Francisco bankers to assess whether he did have oil so that he could sell the rights to them and then become truly wealthy. The bankers did not find oil, but did like his ranching business and offered to give him some loans. Aharon took the loans that they gave and later pumped it back into buying more crops and expanding his acreage into the ranches that he owned. Then the recession hit. Aharon was behind on his payments for several months and had to forfeit all the land that he owned in the San Joaquin Valley. This would mark Kirk's entrance to his new life of living in Los Angeles. Aharon, meanwhile, did not give up his entrepreneurial spirit, and Kirk witnessed the ebbs and flows of his father's life of trying to become wealthy again. His father was not afraid to bet big again and again. One of those times, Aharon noticed that watermelons were not being sold in the markets in Los Angeles because there was too much rain and not enough sunshine needed for them to bloom. The owners of the crops decided to book the loss on their watermelons. Aharon, on the other hand, decided to bet big and went back to the same place he went broke and drove hours negotiating contracts to the futures of the crops of watermelons. During the season, all the weather patterns showed that there would be no rain again. Aharon did not like to listen to crowds. He bet big anyway. And lo and behold, there was a full month of sweltering heat that came to the San Joaquin Valley and watermelons started to bloom again. Aharon was the person who had ownership of most of the production of the crops in the marketplace and took full advantage of it. He'd make a fortune again in the 20s, but again, he'd parlay this win to making more bold bets and again would go broke. This is where Kirk Kerkorian would learn his first early lesson that he'd take with him for the rest of his life. If he wanted to take risks, it'd have to be done independently on his own. Struggling to earn ends meet, Kirk worked as a newspaper boy as a child and would take his own risks to have fun like other kids without paying much money. He'd make a habit of sneaking into movie theaters and other concert venues by creatively planning different ways he and his best friend could get in. Eventually, with Kirk getting older and the family needing a more stable way to make money, while his father kept chasing his dream of being wealthy, Kirk had to drop out of school entirely and start working full-time in the eighth grade. He'd do a series of jobs to help the family. He would do things like fixing cars, he'd work in the CCC in the 1930s during the Great Depression, which was established by FDR. Then he would go after the footsteps of his brother with the dream of being truly wealthy by becoming a professional boxer. His brother got into boxing early and tried to achieve financial independence first. But because he got into the sport very early on in his teens, he essentially retired because of the constant blows to the head in the 100-plus fights he was in. Kirk, on the other hand, learned from his brother and entered the sport at 16 years old. While picking up early wins from knockouts and the nickname Rifle Right Kirkorian, he was still struggling to make money. So he still took different odd jobs on the side. In one of those odd jobs, he went with a friend to fix a fridge. And the story goes that after they were done, his friend wanted to make a stop at the local airport, where he wanted to practice flying. Kirk was seeing all this and he was intrigued. He'd pay the 50 cents to board one of these flights, and his whole life plan changed. He now wanted to become a pilot. Kirk quit boxing and quickly signed up to take lessons. He was obsessed. He spent countless hours each week learning to become a pilot and even surpassed his friend and became an instructor within 2 years. He wanted to become a commercial pilot to take advantage of what was happening in World War II, but couldn't because he lacked the education needed to get the designation. He realized that to get a license, he had to find a fellow rule breaker that already got theirs. So he went to the only person that got their license without the formal education. That person was Florence Poncho Low Barnes. She got her nickname Poncho because she pretended to be a man and got her license to then become a pilot that broke the records of Amelia Earhart. She ended up owning a ranch of her own where she taught flying and took care of her stable of animals. Kirkorian knew she was the one that could help and persuaded her to enroll in the academy and work his way up to becoming a commercial pilot. She agreed, and eventually he did just that. With his commercial pilot's license, he went to another flight academy and was now in charge of instructing and giving designations to future pilots as well. He'd make a stable income, but his first chance at truly making money eventually came when World War II hit. The Army needed Air Force pilots, but the more lucrative opportunity actually came in Canada. The Royal Air Force of the United Kingdom needed pilots to fly the planes they made in Canada back to England. This job was far more dangerous than actually being a World War II fighter pilot because these very planes did not have the capabilities of flying that far. Kirkorian fully embraced the risk for the reward. He'd take multiple planes overseas to England in different near-death journeys and eventually stopped after the war was over. Kirk made a good amount of money, but where he would truly become a millionaire would come at the end of the war when the United States had a surplus of planes that were no longer needed. While many of the planes for sale were a bargain, again, Kirkorian went for the highest risk but the highest reward deals. Those came in Hawaii. If he could fly the planes for sale in Hawaii to LA, he figured he could double his money selling it as soon as he landed. The problem was, just like his job with the Royal Air Force, the planes literally could not make that distance without getting gas between the flights. That's why the opportunity existed. But Kirk was very creative. He installed more fuel chambers on the plane before taking off. He figured if he could put 8 extra tanks, he could make it there no problem. But this would be the seminal moment of his career that would define the risk-taking he did for the rest of his life. Now imagine, you're Kirk Kerkorian. You've figured out the ultimate solution to getting the cheapest deals in Hawaii, where you can make a killing selling them in California. You buy some cheap tanks and you install them on the plane and make sure there's nothing more than fuel for the journey. You take off and everything is fine. You're a couple hours in the air and you can see nothing but ocean. While you're resting on the plane with nothing to do, you hear a siren. Low gas. You thought by this point, you'd only have used only two or three of the eight tanks you installed. You quickly assess the situation and realize that some of the tanks were not installed properly. And now you have two tanks left. You are in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. What do you do? You do exactly what Kirk Kerkorian did. You panic. But he also tried to keep the load of the plane down to conserve as much gas as possible. There was actually many news stories at this time when the whole dilemma happened and Kirk thought he was going to die. But somehow, miraculously, he saw the airfield and made an emergency landing. Kerkorian himself knew how risky of a proposition this ended up being when he said about the matter, "I should have died. And I didn't." He'd keep flying and selling planes to make his money until he bought an academy of his own and then his own airline. This will now take us to our first big deal of Kerkorian's career, starting his own airline. Now let's get into it. Kirk Kerkorian by this point had the career to write a full book, but that's not why we're here. Kerkorian was unique in finding ways to make money in risky ventures where most went bust. He ran his businesses with flexibility to take advantage of market opportunities and would take big risks when the time came for it. This is how he made his first $80 to $100 million in the 60s, by the way. And we will go over how this set up the blueprint for his future deals. Kerkorian's investment career came after buying and selling planes from the government and operating his own flight academy, and then selling that as well. He took all the cash he amassed and during this time period and purchased 8 planes in Hawaii to sell in Brazil where he could earn triple what he paid, but later realized that the prices they were paying there was essentially the same that he would sell in LA. From the advice of his accountant, however, Kerkorian devised a new plan to make more money trading the planes he owned. He wanted to buy planes, then operate them while he waited to find a buyer. By doing this, his accountant figured that he could depreciate the planes on his books because he flew them, and then can sell them without paying a higher tax. It turns out that the planes did not actually depreciate much when they were in use, but would rather break down if you kept them in storage. This was the perfect plan for Kerkorian. He ended up making his first acquisition buying the Los Angeles Air Service for $60,000 in 1947. The airline had 3 planes, office space at the LAX, and a certificate of air charter service. And now with this new airline, he'd do the plan that he and his accountant came up with. He'd fly people all over the West while he continued to buy and sell planes. It was a twofold strategy to diversify his business. He mostly bought and sold planes as the main driver for how he made profit. His competitors, on the other hand, focused mostly on flying the planes. Back in the 40s, and much like today, the airline industry was a brutal business with razor-thin margins after accounting for labor and other costs to make flights happen. Kerkorian made sure to do flights himself to save on labor and to focus on doing few profitable flights just to keep them in the air long enough so that he can depreciate his assets. He'd lease these planes to his competitors who want to gain market share in the airline industry while he'd continue to buy and sell more planes. But by staying lean, he'd ultimately get his major opportunity to become a real airline through his knowledge as a dealer in planes. He'd buy a cargo plane used to transport cattle and restore it into a commercial airliner for passengers. Usually, it would cost around $150,000 back then to have a commercial airliner, but through his knowledge of dealing planes, he'd pay $70,000 for the cargo plane and $28,000 in restoring the plane to get it under market cost. But the sudden realization to make this whole deal came from the news of the Korean War. The oversupply of planes from World War II was now over. The military needed planes, and Kerkorian just restored a plane under market cost that he can now use for military flights. The airline part of his business was now more profitable than dealing planes, and the plane he just purchased was now worth 2 times more because of the newfound demand for planes at this time. Before the plane services were no longer needed, Kerkorian sold the plane for a great profit. And because the military had no use again for these planes and new regulations forcing small-time airlines to go out of business, Kirk again quickly switched back to dealing planes again. With the market falling once more, he could then use his knowledge of planes to find undervalued deals and trade them. He'd then trade his way through shrewd deals to afford a DC-6 plane, which was the exact plane needed to start an airline again. Demand was coming back on the market. This time, there was demand to do international flights. Kerkorian changed the name from Los Angeles Air Services to Trans International Airlines and started flying his DC-6 all around the world while making a profit, being one of the only airlines that can handle flights of this capacity. Then he'd make his biggest deal to continue his dominance in the market as an international airline. He finally waited to make his biggest deal yet, and this would come in the form of buying a $5 million jet called the DC-8. Kerkorian knew if you had this jet, he could go to destinations even farther and could get more government contracts to do these jobs. The problem was, Kerkorian did not have anything close to the $5 million needed to buy this plane at this time. Kerkorian ran the airline profitably with his opportunistic deals he made buying and selling planes, while also taking advantage of starting and stopping his airline business when lucrative contracts came. But he was only making a few $100,000 a year in his pocket, ultimately. He'd convince his banker from Bank of America to give him a loan, and he'd put all the cash he had to then make this purchase happen. He went all in. But now he had a DCA, and because he knew the demand that the government had for their transport contracts, he won all kinds of contracts to transport things around the world for them. With the profits he made from these contracts, he got to buy 2 more DC-8s and now became an official airline in the market with a considerable fleet. Now we will get into how Kerkorian became a master dealmaker in buying and selling his own company to make a huge profit. This is a deal that would put him on the map as an investor. The first case came in 1968 where Studebaker, a car company, wanted to diversify their holdings and saw how successful TIA had become. Kerkorian sold TIA to Studebaker for $1 million in stock in 1963. He would get paid in more shares to operate TIA. Kerkorian would then buy more jets to be a real airline commercially and started flying passengers in groups around the world. He realized that by selling in groups, he can offer a lower price to each individual while guaranteeing him a full plane to fly. Then realizing again that the demand was sliding in airline travel, he'd sell his stock in Studebaker. He sold his stock so that he could eventually buy TIA back from the company. Kerkorian again was being opportunistic and was waiting for his time to buy the company. In the book, Kerkorian, an American Success Story, Dial Torgensen talks about Kerkorian's process, saying, Kerkorian talks to his banker, to his financial man, to his lawyer. What do they think about such and such plan? And he quietly begins to make a checklist. If I do A, he figures B and C will happen. What if C does not? Then I'll do D. And in case of emergency, I could do E. It is when Kerkorian makes out his checklist that he makes the decision. And it, his decision, not a committee decision. So what was that checklist for buying back TIA? Torgensen gives us an idea, saying, A, organize a corporation to make the sale. B, sell Studebaker's stock for a supply of liquid cash. C, get an option to buy TIA back from Studebaker. D, borrow the purchase price from the bank. E, go public and pay back the bank. And finally, F, if no underwriter will handle the offering, sell one of the DC-8s to pay back the bank. This was exactly how the plan turned out, and he'd use his funds of selling stock to go down to Studebaker headquarters and then get an option to buy TIA back for $2.5 million in cash. While Studebaker thought that they had made a profit, this was all cash that Kerkorian got from owning their stock from their purchase of the airline and their pay to him while he operated it for a year. Kerkorian then planned to take TIA public and then use the same stockbroker who helped him sell his company to Studebaker to help with the public offering. But there are two problems. Number one, TIA was not an official airline like TWA. They only had a few planes, and the majority of their business was doing infrequent military contracts to fly passengers or group flights for certain organizations. And number two, because his company was very small compared to his competitors, and the way the airline made money was different than his competitors, nobody wanted to take this company public. But Kerkorian had a creative solution to both of these problems. The first one came from good bluffing on his part. He tells that same stockbroker that he got an offer to take his company public and let him know if they had a competitive offer. The stockbroker then went straight to his boss and proceeded to sell him on the opportunity of taking TIA public, saying that there were other firms who wanted to do it, which forced his boss to make a quick offer to do it on better terms. Once that was agreed upon, Kirk gave his stockbroker the ultimate task of selling enough shares to make the IPO happen. His stockbroker was a junior person in the company, and usually higher level people in the firm take this, but because he trusted this person so much and gave the task of doing it, his stockbroker went above and beyond to get these shares sold. But one interesting twist in all of this is Kerkorian's stockbroker was Armenian like him. So to get the shares sold, who does he go to? The biggest Armenian community where Kirk himself used to be part of, Fresno. The stockbroker sold the community on the vision of Kerkorian taking this plane company to be a huge business that they could all profit from. Their loyalty to a fellow Armenian not only allowed the shares to sell out, but it actually made the stock climb to unprecedented heights. In a year after the IPO, shares went from $9 to $35. Kirk got to sell 23% of the company through a secondary offering and keep 77% while getting to pay off the loans the company incurred. The timing couldn't have been better because he had also strategically used the cash to build the airline's fleets to be a true charter airline at the same exact time there was a boom in the industry. By 1968, he had turned his $2.5 million purchase of TIA in 1964 into $66 million. But again, Kerkorian saw that the company was throwing cash, and he thought it was the peak of the market cycle in his industry. So he knew it was time to sell. And this time, Transamerica, another conglomerate made up of Bank of America's old assets, approached Kerkorian to buy the airline since it was one of the few reputable airlines in the United States that was making money profitably with room to grow since it was still an early small player. He then quickly struck another deal to sell his airline for $148 million, with Kerkorian's share worth $85 million in Transamerica stock. But he was on the move again, this time not with airlines, but with hotels. He decided to put up his shares to get loans to start investing in Las Vegas. And because his shares were appreciating in Transamerica stock, his net worth by 1969 in Transamerica stock was $104 million. Now we will go over the deals that we now know Kirk Kerkorian for. His hotel deals in Las Vegas. We already went over how Kerkorian did his deals through his checklist and trying to think through scenarios. We know that Kerkorian was never wed to any of his companies and was always alert on when to sell his businesses when he deemed it was a good time to sell. But his investment mind did not just focus on airlines. He was always observant of what was going on around him. And when he was flying his plane for passengers back when he was running his airline, the LA Air Services, he noticed the booming market of Las Vegas. The problem with Vegas back then, however, was that it was controlled by the mob. It was not a market to invest in thinking you can make a return when you are dealing with criminals and constant government surveillance. But while he observed the demand that Vegas presented, another pilot would turn this industry around to being a real place to do business. That person was Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes had just sold his company, Hughes Tool Co., and did not want to pay the high taxes on the sale, so he moved to Nevada. At first, he stayed at the luxury suites in the Sands Hotel, but after the owner of the hotel wanted him out so he could sell the rooms for the New Year's parties, Hughes instead bought the hotel and casino from this person for $13.2 million. This then became his permanent residence. Flush with cash from the sale and being the visionary that he is, he told his team to buy even more hotels, and he ended up being the single biggest casino owner on the strip in a few short years. Hughes' vision was to buy as much land as possible so he could build a whole new city where he could profit from the best business that the city provided, casinos. Usually when a person's buying a majority of an industry, it'd be considered anti-competitive. But the Vegas Gambling Commission let it slide. Why? Because he ran out the mob in the city. He paid them all off, and because of that, he legitimized the industry. This allowed investment capital to rush in, and other than Hughes, another aviator would take full advantage of this. Kirk Kerkorian. I mean, yeah, it's obvious. That's what the episode's about. But anyway, Kerkorian frequently went to Vegas back when he was piloting his planes under the LA Air Services airline that he ran. He understood the demand and was a frequent gambler himself. His first foray into the business side, however, ended in a big loss. He was part of the investment group for another hotel, and this time, however, he did not have operating control of the investment. The person in charge ran it into the ground, and Kerkorian lost millions of dollars. From then on, Kerkorian knew that if he was ever going to do deals, he needed control. It was the same thing he learned when he was a kid. So he did not shy away after his first loss and did what he did with the airplane business. Instead of running a business, he wanted to trade assets, the land. He'd make money buying and selling different parts of the land all over the strip while he was orchestrating his IPO of TIA. In one deal, he buys acres of land that did not have access to the front of the strip for a high price at the time. He then trades some of that acreage to the owners who had the frontage and then got some of that frontage along with the part of the land that he had. It was a win-win deal because he had vast land that now can be built on the strip. Kerkorian wanted to make another run at operating a casino and had originally negotiated this deal so he could build his own resort, but he had cold feet and decided that he did not really understand the industry too well yet, and rather than take another big risk, he'd rather book the win on the land deal and lease it to someone else. That someone else was a man named Jay Sarno. Sarno had the vision to build the first mega resort on the strip. And after Kerkorian had negotiated to get the frontage needed to be on the strip, Sarno jumped in to make the deal happen. Sarno was also a man like Kerkorian who had visited Vegas many times throughout the 60s as a gambler. And back then, that's all it took to create your own casino. That's Sarno's story. In the book Super Casino, it tells this story saying, Sarno had never built a casino. He had never built a strip resort. He had never operated either one. He had been to Las Vegas only on gambling junkets. Sarno was the youngest of seven children and the one who was always a disappointment. After an undistinguished youth, he had spent World War II running dice games in the Air Force. His mother enrolled him in the University of Missouri after he was discharged. But Sarno spent most of his time playing poker at the Zeta Beta Tau fraternity house. His future best friend and business partner, Stanley Malin, met Sarno there in 1946. After 4 years, Malin graduated with a business degree, but Sarno had only completed about half the required courses. Let's go to Miami Beach, Sarno suggested. I've got a cousin working there who says he can get us into the tile business. Jay, we don't know anything about installing tile, Malin protested. And within a week, they were bidding on the tile jobs at the Miami Beach hotels. They hired craftsmen to do the actual work and made their profit by taking a contractor's fee. So how does the story bring us to today? They then took their tile business to Atlanta because it had less competition and started building apartments in the city. Eventually, Sarno branched into building office buildings and got the idea to create a motel. He got his loans from the Teamster unions, and after successfully building one motel in Atlanta, he toured the country finding more places to build them. On this very trip was when he went to Vegas and then subsequently came up with the idea to build a resort. Sarno went to Teamster president Jimmy Hoffa to get a loan for this new project. Hoffa gave him a loan after bringing in a consortium of investors to help with the project, and by 1962, they needed a place to buy land. That is when he met up with Kerkorian and cut a deal at the same exact time Kerkorian was planning on leasing the land. They agreed to rent the land for $190,000 a year, plus 15% of the casino's gross profits. While this was one hell of a deal to make for Kerkorian, the consequences of this deal were a lot more profound. Sarno did not just create an ordinary casino. He wanted to build the biggest and most luxurious casino on the Strip. It took 4 years to build it, and it was the start of a new era in Vegas. The era of the mega resorts. In the book Super Casinos, it describes Jay Sarno's new hotel, Caesar's Palace, saying, "Guests were supposed to feel as if they had stepped back into the glorious days of ancient Rome. Unlike other resorts, Caesar's was set back from the highway. Its crescent-shaped, 14-story tower contained 680 luxury suites, a 135-foot-long driveway lined with Italian cypresses, 18 fountains that sprayed 350,000 gallons of water per minute, and marble worth $150,000 at the time, imported from Florence, Italy. It had cost them way above their budget of $10 million to build the hotel. With all the costs added up, they paid $25 million in the mid-60s to finish this project. They were stretched thin and did not have enough money to cover the balances in case gamblers won on the first day. But Sarno didn't care and spent $1 million on the first 3 days of the opening to promote the resort. And what was the result of all of this? A giant success. Caesar's Palace set a new standard in Vegas, and it was now making so much money that they had to separate it by weight rather than counting because they did not have the time to do it. Kerkorian, on the other hand, was seeing everything because it was all being built on the land that he owned. Remember, he was leasing it to them. He saw how successful this type of resort had been, and this becomes one of the best deals of his career at this time. In the deal, he got a paid out percentage of his lease in the sales from the casino. So he had turned his small investment into millions of dollars per year because of the success of Caesar's Palace. But he earned something more important from this deal. Insight into a whole new business model that was working exceedingly well in Las Vegas. The mega resort. Caesar's Palace at this time was the biggest casino in the country. Kerkorian, in a lot of ways, took a risk by letting them use his land to build this kind of project. But after he built it, he saw firsthand how successful this concept was. So when it came time for him to sell his company to Transamerica for $140 million, he already knew what he wanted to do with the cash he had. He wanted to build the biggest resort in the world. This time, however, he made an even bolder bet than Caesar's. He thought the reason why everybody flocked to Caesar's had less to do with being on the Strip and more to do with being a big resort that people wanted to visit at the time. So he bought a giant piece of land that was a mile off the Strip. But again, he went back to his checklist methodology, and Torgensen, in his book, tells us what the plan was for the hotel, saying, A, buy an existing hotel. B, buy a site for a really big new one. C, train staff at the old hotel. D, borrow enough money to build a new one and move the staff into it. E, go public with the whole deal and pay off the loan on the new hotel. F, sell off the old one. And finally, G, make the second offering to finance other big moves. Kerkorian moved quickly and identified that the Flamingo Hotel was a good enough target to buy. The purpose of this acquisition was to use it as a training ground of sorts for staff, so that when the new hotel that he built is ready, he can move that staff to manage it. Then he paid $5 million for an 82-acre site on Paradise Road, which was 3.5 miles off the strip. He paid $12.5 million for the Flamingo Hotel, and then paid an additional $2.4 million to upgrade the resort. Everything was going to plan. He just now needed to get the loan to build the hotel. This was the part that Kerkorian thought was the easiest. He had a great relationship with Bank of America from way back when he was buying and selling planes for himself. He used them more recently to help him with some of the loans through the IPO of TIA, which he paid back to them in 5 months. But when he went to them this time around, they quickly declined. It turned out that Bank of America had an even bigger and more reliable client, Howard Hughes. And he did not like the moves Kerkorian was making. So he went out of his way and did everything in his power to stop Kerkorian's hotel from going up. He planted stories where he said he'd make an even bigger hotel than Kerkorian's. He stopped Bank of America from giving him money to build the hotel. He even tried to build his own tower near Kerkorian's hotel to steer people away from it, but it didn't work. Kerkorian went back to his old tricks, and this time he had his own money as well. He decided to keep the Flamingo and use it and the land he bought for his new hotel called the International Hotel to form a new company called International Leisure. He used the same stockbroker that took TIA public to IPO this company, where he would put up $16.6 million in the IPO. He'd use the proceeds from the IPO to build the International Hotel. 16 months after the IPO, the International Hotel opened its doors, and it was a huge success. Kerkorian took a page out of Sarno's book and had built the International Hotel to be a place that was much more luxurious than anything the Strip had seen before. Kerkorian made the International to span different regions across the globe throughout the whole hotel. I want to give you guys a glimpse of just how detailed the hotel really was, because Kerkorian was a great investor and did make things pencil out first, but the level of detail he had on the project was what ultimately made it a great investment. In the ad, it reads, "Sleep in Madrid, or Rome, or Paris. When you drive up to the new International Hotel, you begin a tour of the world. The flags of the free world are blowing in the breeze. The doorman isn't a doorman. He's a French gendarme. The lobby isn't a lobby. It's more like a palace at Versailles. And when you register, you receive an international passport. You may stay in Paris, or Rome, or Madrid. Each floor is done in international decor. And only king or double-sized beds in all rooms. Color TV with remote control. All that a world traveler wants and deserves." Another reason for the hotel's success, however, was also because the entertainment Kerkorian put in the resort. He built the biggest theater in Vegas at that time and booked Elvis Presley to play there. Today, we could clearly see the influence of Elvis on Vegas with the many impersonators on the Strip, but if it wasn't for the International Hotel, Elvis would not have revived his career and became the staple that he now is in the city of Las Vegas. And in terms of timing, Kerkorian IPO International Leisure at the perfect time, because it was a booming market in the late 60s, so by the time the hotel opened its doors, his $16.6 million turned into $180 million, giving him a total net worth of around $272 million by the end of 1969. Kerkorian was on a hot streak and saw even more opportunities, but this time his risk-taking almost cost him his whole net worth. And we will get into that now, moving on to his next deal, which was him purchasing MGM Studios. But let's back up for a second. At this point in Kerkorian's career, he was one of the wealthiest men in all of the United States. His net worth would equal around $2.3 billion today. He was 52 years old at this point and could have hung it up and called it a career, and I would have still made an episode. But he saw another massive opportunity to take advantage of: movie studios. While leisure activities like airlines, casinos kept rising in value during the economic boom of the 60s, Hollywood was in a rut. Moviegoing went from an audience of 87 million people in 1947 to 15 million by 1970. Unemployment shot up during the early 70s as well, with there being over 50% of the people in the industry without a job. All the while, it kept getting more and more expensive to make films. The TV took over and the studios of old had to change. Kerkorian had the idea to look into the studio business in the late 60s because he was still the largest shareholder of Transamerica from his TIA sale. Transamerica did a series of acquisitions to diversify their holdings and ended up buying United Artists, which was another big studio. United Artists at this point was more of a distributor and not an actual studio, and made money renting its facilities to other studios while making a share of the profits on successful films. It was very similar to the Caesar's Palace deal that Kerkorian did. But with the International Hotel, Kerkorian was weighing up his options for his next play and got one person on his team to study other studios to see if he can own one himself. He tried to buy different studios but had difficulties of getting the control he wanted for his investments. He already made that mistake twice and he did not want to make it a third time. But this time he studied and learned about MGM. MGM was the biggest studio at the time and was known for movies like Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz, and Singing in the Rain. They'd go through many different studio executives who'd try to find a new film to make a hit for the studio, but it just was not working. The industry had a problem on its hands. They had a business model that was being disrupted by TV programming, and the company had a balance sheet with a bunch of assets like the land of the studios that they own and their old film catalog. The industry had its problems, but also had ample assets to take advantage of if you could turn the studio around. While many investors would try their hand at it, Kerkorian would jump in buying a majority stake in the studio and had a plan devised of his own. Remember, Kerkorian loved to look at the balance sheets for his investments. But this time, however, the asset in question he was looking to own was not real estate of MGM, it wasn't the film library, and it definitely wasn't the old collectible memorabilia like Dorothy's slippers. It was the brand. MGM had a prestige in old Hollywood that everyone recognized, and Kerkorian knew that it would be valuable to his plans. Now, the book Kerkorian, an American Success Story by Dial Torgensen did not have this Kerkorian checklist for this venture, but I made my own to see what Kerkorian was seeing with the following checklist. A. Borrow money from your stock in International Leisure to get a controlling share in MGM. B. Sell off assets at MGM to make the company cash flow positive. C. Hire a new studio executive that will keep MGM profitable. D. Announce a secondary offering at the International Leisure to pay off your MGM loans. And finally, E. Announce a new venture for MGM, the MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas. Yes, that was the ultimate plan by Kerkorian. Buy in cheap to get control of a brand name that you could use to build another mega resort in Vegas. He figured out the model perfectly with the International Hotel. But while he tried to go through with his plan, it became increasingly harder to raise money that he needed to invest in MGM. He'd sell all of his Transamerica stock and then pay off some of the debts from his other ventures so that he had a clean slate to raise more money for his venture into owning MGM. While he first went to get funding at a bank owned by Transamerica, shareholders of MGM tried to block this loan and purchase agreement because Transamerica owned United Artists, deeming their investment would be anti-competitive. Court cases ensued that tried to stop Kerkorian, but as always, once he was sure about an investment, he did not let anything or anyone get in his way. So he flew to Europe and lined up financing there. But this type of financing was not as friendly as the loans he would get in the States. To fund his purchase of 41% of MGM, Kerkorian got loans from European banks where he had to pay high interest and put up 150% of the collateral. He'd end up borrowing over $100 million in loans from these banks so that he could buy up a majority share of the company. He had some problems with other shareholders like the Bronfmans, trying to stop him from getting control, but once he got his funding, there was really no one to stop him unless they bought shares themselves. And remember, the studio was failing at this time, so nobody really wanted to do that either. So Kerkorian then got control of the studio, and then went on with his part of the plan and gotten rid of a whole bunch of assets to get the company back into shape. MGM had a giant garage sale of sorts and sold some of the real estate, the camera department, and even sold some theaters they owned around the world. He'd hired Jim Aubrey to take the reins at MGM to take charge of selling the assets and make the business more lean. And everything was starting to take shape except for one thing. The country had now gone into a recession. His International Leisure stock went tumbling, and he had a huge loan to pay with high interest rates to all these European banks due soon. So he had to sell each asset of his own for bottom price. He sold his 51% interest in International Leisure for $16.6 million, where he took a personal $71 million loss on the sale. He sold his home in Nevada. He sold his yacht, his private plane, and he had to give the $5 million dividend he got from International Leisure stock in order to pay off his loans from the banks and keep his majority share in a Hollywood studio that was now worth a lot less than the loans he took on to buy those shares. When asked about how this all happened, Kerkorian said in an interview, "I had a real game plan. You'll never know. If I made that secondary, I had one more move tied in perfectly with what I wanted to do. It would have tied all the things together." And surprisingly, what stopped Kerkorian was, in his own words, not the high leverage that he used to make the MGM purchase or a recession. It was the secondary sale of International Leisure stock that he planned on doing at this time, but was blocked. Why was he blocked? Because in 1970, the SEC had blocked the offering because the Justice Department was investigating one of his assets for ties with the mob. The asset in question, the Flamingo Hotel. The same hotel that he didn't really consider as an investment, but more so as a hotel school to train his staff. The Flamingo had been owned by mobsters before he bought it, and the Justice Department wanted to see who exactly had ownership in it as part of their investigation. When Kerkorian tried to get the SEC to sign off on his offering, he had no idea about this investigation. Until the SEC blocked the offering, saying that they needed to investigate his ownership in the Flamingo Hotel. And they tried to influence him to give them information on the Flamingo so he can actually do the secondary. So they weren't really investigating him. They're investigating the old ownership, and they knew he had the information. So since he wanted to do the secondary and they wanted his information, they kind of blackmailed him into trying to give up the information in order to do the secondary. The problem was that Kerkorian did not have the paperwork for the Flamingo before he owned it. Remember, his sole intention for purchasing the hotel was not actually to operate it. It was actually to train the staff to then move to the International Hotel. So he did not actually care too much about the hotel as a business. It was bought because it was big enough to hire and train a staff that he could quickly transfer for the opening of his new resort. He wanted to quickly sell it. It was literally just pay up for the hotel because it was big enough to train the staff. And then once you could transfer the staff into the International Hotel, he would sell the Flamingo and not want to keep it. It was that small change of plans of him keeping the Flamingo that ultimately stopped him from owning all his assets and then paying off the MGM to having an even bigger net worth. He took a big hit because he did not sell the Flamingo like he intended to. But clearly, to the SEC, none of this mattered. The secondary was blocked and a recession started, causing the downfall of Kerkorian's business career. But just like his dad, Kerkorian wasn't going to let a few slip-ups turn him away. He'd learn from his mistakes and eventually take over Hollywood, Vegas, and even the automotive industries, to becoming one of the richest people in the country by 2007. And that journey will be covered on the next episode for part 2 of the Kerkorian story. But before we finish the episode on Kerkorian's early career, we have to go over some of the lessons of why he was so successful. Let's tie this all in together, because there's still a lot to learn from his early career. Number one, the biggest lesson in all of this was how he took on the riskiest deals that had the highest payouts. Kerkorian had this pattern since he was a child. He was sneaking into restaurants and theaters many wealthy people had a hard time getting into. When he became a pilot, he could have done what he originally planned on doing, which was becoming a fighter pilot for the Air Force during the war. But when he was presented an even bigger pay to fly planes across the globe for the Royal Air Force, he took it. When there was a huge surplus of planes across the country, he could have gotten a bargain on any plane that he bid on. But he decided to get the cheapest planes on the market that were only cheap because they did not have the capabilities to go back to the States. He is very much a burn the boats type of person. And even in his later deals, you will see that he goes in big at the start and then develops his edge and is not as risk-taking as before. His start in the plane business was doing those risky deals in Hawaii where he almost died buying and selling planes. But over time, he used his cash to make less risky deals all around the country and just became a really well-skilled plane dealer. In Vegas, he saw the allure of the casino business and paid a lot to own a casino, and by all means, it was risky and he lost all his money on that deal. But by no means was he reckless. He went for the highest outcomes. He focused on the right tail of the distribution while knowing that he exposed himself to the left tail outcome as well. The main lesson within this is being mindful of the deals that you do and fully understanding the full range of outcomes when you do these deals. While Kerkorian knew the Hawaii planes were not going to get all the way to California, he tried to mitigate his risk by installing more fuel tanks to get there, but it was the unknowns that almost got him in trouble. But another lesson from taking on these risky deals was he learned how to quickly find a solution to a very big problem. He learned this first lesson after luckily landing and did his homework on how to make other plane deals work so that he could become one of the only experts in the space. It was this expertise that allowed him to be one of the top plane dealers in the country and to innovatively fix planes in other ways that people could not see. Two investors that we covered this series were like this as well. Donald Brent jumped into developing Mission Viejo with no real experience and got a quick education in community building to see how great the Irvine Company opportunity was when the deal presented itself. Philip Anschutz jumped into buying railroads without having a great plan to fix them, and from that constraint bred the creativity to see the hidden asset, which was their telecom installation subsidiary, which then became his biggest deal, Quest. In a great presentation from a couple years ago from the great Twitter account at NeckerValue, investor Alex Pasquet described the qualities of great investors and talks about an environment he likes to call futsal situations for learning. What he means by this is being in an environment where you could get a lot of repetitions to understand something in a limited amount of time. For a lot of these investors, their futsal environments was actually being in the field during a down market. There was a lot going on in the market with airplanes being sold by the government after the war. And by going headfirst into the riskiest deals, he got to outlearn his peers and got to understand what planes people needed and why they needed them. This knowledge allowed him to understand where the market was going and eventually led to him creating a real airline where he made most of his money from. This now brings us to the second big lesson from this episode, which was his flexibility in the way that he ran his investments. Kerkorian got into the plane dealing business after making a couple of profitable deals, but he was open-minded and used the advice of his accountant to start an airline to depreciate his planes to save money on taxes. But he did not only run the airline for this purpose. He was very opportunistic on the ways the market was moving in airline travel, and when he saw it was a great time to fully operate the airline, he would stop buying and selling planes and would focus on the airline itself. But when market demand was not there, he would go back to dealing planes again. And he was the same exact way with his Vegas deals. While he intended for the first land purchase he made to go towards making his own casino, he was flexible and was not hell-bent on building it out. He leased the land and ultimately got the understanding of how to run a casino by leasing it to Jay Sarno, and this was what eventually made him one of the richest in the country at the time, because he used the insight of seeing what Sarno made to then build the biggest resort in the world on his own. It was this flexibility of buying and selling assets that gave Kerkorian the reputation he now has of buying back assets for much less than he sold to fix them up and then sell them again. He made a lot of money throughout his career just buying and selling the same assets, whether it was his companies, planes, hotels. This is like a common thing for Kerkorian, and it's very much due to his flexibility of how he looked at his companies and assets more generally. Kerkorian did this with TIA by selling it to Studebaker first and then buying it back, IPOing it, and then selling it back to Transamerica within 3 years. He saw the opportunity to buy back his businesses when he realized that it was undervalued and that the market demand was going to increase. He did not think of starting another airline or to do it through Studebaker, but instead saw the opportunity to IPO the airline itself to raise the money needed to upgrade the fleet and to take advantage of the market. Then when another company came a year or so later to offer a buyout, even though he just made the company public, it was his flexibility again that got him to make a quick return on his investment that turned his ownership in a small airline into the biggest shareholder of Bank of America's old conglomerate, Transamerica. This is just something to keep in mind for all of those long-term thinkers out there. I think being flexible is a great skill to have and to not be too bought into having a grand vision for the investments that you make. It is fine to have it as a guiding principle, but you always have to be open enough to see an opportunity to either exit your investment when the thesis is proven wrong or sell when something unexpectedly good that happens that you should take up. Kerkorian liked the price he got with Studebaker and sold and then bought it back, sensing a bigger opportunity, and then quickly sold it again when he thought the value was good enough. He is quoted in a Fortune article in the late 60s saying, he likes to have a little meat on the bone when making deals, meaning he is open to selling when he believes the value of the deal is good enough. He's not trying to extract as much value as he can. And with that, I will now conclude our first episode on Kirk Kerkorian. In the next episode, we will talk more about how Kerkorian got himself out of his mess with MGM, how he continued to buy and sell the studio to reap billions in profits, and how he made billions investing into the decline of the automotive industry. If you enjoyed this episode, please share my podcast and leave a review. I'll see you guys on the next episode. See you later.